Olha só, primeiro que a gente tá aqui e a gente tem um podcast, desculpa, tem um podcast que a gente já faz há alguns anos, tem um Instagram que a galera criou pra gente, muito obrigado, que é o EUVNO, e a gente tem o imenso prazer de dizer que a gente tem um patrocínio. A Morada dos Canyons tá com a gente, em Praia Grande, na divisa do Rio Grande do Sul com Santa Catarina, a gente sempre faz o desafio de entrar no Instagram da Morada dos Canyons. É absolutamente apaixonante. Entre no Instagram da Morada dos Canyons que vocês vão ver o quão lindo é esse patrocinador deste querido podcast chamado Era Uma Vez no Oeste, que a gente teve uma conversa no nosso grupo e a gente vai fazer uma grande exceção. De verdade. A gente espera que vocês gostem, porque esse material não pode se perder. O Escola vinha citando ele nos últimos tempos aqui, porque ele teve uma conversa de mais de uma hora com Niall Ferguson, professor, historiador, um cara de muitos e muitos livros, né, que trata a história e tem uma visão muito clara de mundo, mesmo a gente concordando, ou, desculpa, mesmo a gente discordando de algumas coisas. Ele faz a gente pensar. É uma baita de uma entrevista, está em língua inglesa, óbvio que o Escola conversou ele em língua inglesa, e a gente vai fazer questão de colocar aqui no Era Uma Vez no Oeste. É uma edição especial. Né? O segundo dessa semana é uma edição especial. A gente falou, prometeu que ia fazer isso de uma maneira diferente, então tá fazendo aqui, certo? Junto com Morada dos Canyons, Canyons se escreve com Y, Canyons com um N só, um lugar paradisíaco, maravilhoso. Agende um final de semana lá para mudar a sua vida, para acalmar a sua vida, né? E a gente tem agora na íntegra um papo do Daniel Escola com o Niall Ferguson. E a primeira pergunta que o Escola fez, ele não gravou, foi: como é que ele
Probably
estava vivendo
traveled
essa
to
pandemia? Como é
excess
que
in the
ele,
last 20
cidadão,
years.
Nael, estava vivendo a
This
pandemia?
pandemic has
E ele
given
começa
me
respondendo assim.
the opportunity to spend 3 months in one place with my wife and younger children. And it's been wonderful. I feel very fortunate because I can work virtually. Not everybody can. And it turns out that I can say what I think just as easily over Zoom as after a long haul flight to another continent. And indeed, it's easier because I'm not jet lagged. So I think it's been a huge improvement in my quality of life. And I'm not sure I'll ever go back to the old globe-trotting ways. I've seen the world. I prefer Montana.
Right. I remember back in January, you made an alert at the World Economic Forum in Davos about the risks of this pandemic, the coronavirus as a whole. It seems that the leaders at that time didn't take it too serious. Why was that?
I think there were a few leaders who did, and one has to give them credit. The Taiwanese government, the South Korean government, actually, the governments of Australia and New Zealand all did a good job. The Greek government in Europe, oddly enough, I met the Greek Prime Minister at Davos, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, and we did a session together. He was one of the very few people at Davos who understood the point that this could be very, very disruptive. And that's why Greece took relatively early action and has had a good experience of COVID-19. But I think in the UK and the US, it was a very different story. And I might add in Brazil too, because I think two things happened, one obvious and the other much less obvious. The obvious thing that happened was that the leaders themselves were inclined to downplay the risks because they didn't want the economic cost of action. And we know that in their different ways, Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, Jair Bolsonaro downplayed the risk for January, for February, into March. But the other thing that happened, which was really, I think, more important actually, was that the people whose job it was to have a strategy for a pandemic, certainly in the US and the UK, I can't speak for Brazil, the bureaucrats in public health whose responsibility this was got it wrong. And their advice to their governments was not good. So I think the media have tended to emphasize the role of the leaders and to focus on their misjudgments, which is legitimate. But we need to recognize that government's a complex thing, and there are people whose job it is to have a plan for a pandemic. That is what they're paid to do. And in the UK and the US, certainly, those people failed, and failed disastrously.
You said recently that the pandemic was a massive policy screw up. Why was that?
Well, in the countries I know best, the screw up took the following form. During January, February, and early March, when they should have been very active in testing and contact tracing, they did nothing. And then in the middle of March, by which time it was too late, they panicked and they imposed economic lockdowns. And so you got the worst of both worlds. You failed to contain the contagion when it was containable, and then you inflicted a huge recession on yourself with a very blunt instrument called a lockdown. We know from the successful countries that you don't necessarily need to do a lockdown if you get the early policy right. If you have sufficient tracing capacity and testing capacity and tracing capability, then you don't need to lock the economy down. Taiwan did not do lockdown. South Korea did not do lockdown. And so I think that the UK and the US achieved the worst of both worlds, because they did nothing when they should have been active. And then they did something very disruptive, which I don't think had that great a public health benefit, and definitely had a huge economic cost.
How do you think they will be remembered, these leaders?
Well, it's very difficult to answer a question like that, because as you know from many examples, history will often, perhaps unfairly, judge leaders by one or two major decisions they took. Tony Blair, I think, was a very competent prime minister in many ways. And the Blair government, I think, as Labour governments go, was one of the most successful of the 20th century. But he'll always be remembered for a decision as well as the 20th. I think he will be remembered for his decision on the Iraq War, when everything else he did has been forgotten. And in the case of today's leaders, President Bolsonaro might have been remembered for bold economic reforms, which were certainly the story of 2019, had it not been for COVID-19, which has hugely disrupted his government. Donald Trump was likely to be remembered for a reduction of unemployment to historic lows and a remarkable economic recovery until the pandemic struck. But that doesn't mean that they'll be remembered for their mishandling of COVID-19. Already in the United States, the conversation has changed since the murder of George Floyd to the old conversation about race, law and order, police brutality. And it feels as if we're almost forgetting that the pandemic isn't over. In that sense, it's extremely hard to predict what the verdict of history will be on anybody currently in power. It often takes years for these reputations to be decided. Boris Johnson was a tremendously popular figure in Britain late last year and early this year, and his popularity reached a height, a peak, when he himself caught COVID-19. He came out of hospital on Easter Sunday. It was a kind of political resurrection. He even became a father with a new wife, and in the space of just a few weeks, that popularity has evaporated, and he's now in quite a deep hole. From a historian's point of view, the striking thing about reputations is that they're quite volatile while people are in power. You know, you can go from hero to zero and back to hero, depending on luck and good decisions. So it's not over for any of these people. Who knows where we'll be even 6 months from now?
Some people compare this crisis with the World War II. Some people compare with another pandemic in 1918, Spanish influenza in 1918. It might be early, it's true, but how can you place this time in history, judging what you have so far?
This is a difficult question to answer, because in terms of its mortality, the likely overall mortality that COVID-19 causes, I don't think it's going to be one of the 20, maybe even one of the 30 biggest pandemics in history. It's not going to be as disastrous as 1918-19, much less the Black Death. It feels actually, in terms of its likely excess mortality, closer to the 1957-58 influenza pandemic, which was significant, but not so big that anybody really remembers it. And so the critical issue is not necessarily how many people a pandemic kills. It may just be the consequences that make it historically significant. That the consequences of 1957-58 were minimal around the world. But it's clear that the consequences of COVID-19 will be much greater, even if the body count in relative terms is the same. And I think that the consequences will be great because of the huge economic shock that was inflicted by lockdowns, and also because the subsequent political, social and political turmoil that has been created. Now, almost all pandemics have that kind of social consequence. It's disruptive, and the incidence of the disease is not equal. And so you get this turmoil of the sort that we're seeing in the United States and other countries. But I don't think that in itself is of enormous historical significance. I think the two things that will make COVID-19 really historically interesting would be if it put an end to the Trump presidency, if the failures of this year ultimately lead to Trump's defeat, then I think that will be assumed by historians to be a consequence of the pandemic. And the second thing is if the worse, then I think you would say that COVID-19 had at least something to do with Cold War II getting much more intense. I think the key distinction to draw here is between an event itself in terms of its mortality and its broader consequences. World War I killed about 10 million men, mostly young men in combat. World War II killed even more, plus many civilians because of the use of aerial bombardment. But I don't think their significance lay in their death tolls, horrible though those numbers are to think about. I think the significance of World War I lay in the fact that it caused the Russian Revolution and it caused the breakup of the great Eastern Central European empires, and it fundamentally altered the structure of power, making the United States economically dominant. And World War II, again, was significant, not just because of all the people who died, but because it really represented the end of the line for fascism or national socialism as a viable ideology. And it completely confirmed American dominance. So I think with COVID-19, it's not the number of people who die that you need to look at, it's the political and geopolitical consequences, and those are not yet clear.
In terms of the economy, how do you think that pandemic will reshape the world? Is there anything that is calling your attention now?
Well, I think there are at least two obvious consequences. One is that globalization, which was already in retreat since 2007, has been set back further. I think the prospect for economic integration is much dimmer now, because we've had a reaffirmation of the importance of national borders. We've seen China justly criticized for its mishandling of this crisis. So I think globalization is going to continue its retreat. Secondly, I think the kind of economic acceleration of our lives from the actual or physical to the virtual is one of the big consequences. People at Microsoft and Amazon and Google and other tech companies like Zoom were probably imagining that they would get to these volumes of use 10 years from now, and it happened in 6 months. So that's the second. I would add a third, which is that if you look at the US and other economies using massive fiscal and monetary measures to offset the shock of lockdowns, then you have to ask yourself where that all leads. The US is massively increasing the supply of dollars measured by M2 or M3, more than any major central bank. Mm-hmm. At the time when the demand for dollars must be diminishing because trade itself has been reduced. So it feels like, and I think most people would now say this, we're entering a period when the dollar will weaken relative to other currencies. In fact, you've already seen how the Brazilian currencies jumped up relative to the USD. I think the dollar is due a period of weakening, and it's I think driven mainly by monetary policy, but it may also be driven by a perception that the US is a less stable place than we used to think. The US is still mishandling the pandemic. I mean, it's not under control in more than a handful of states, and you've got second waves of COVID-19 in at least 19 states by my count. So this is pretty disastrous performance compared with Europe and compared with East Asia. So my sense is that third impact is a really important one, which will at least impact the standing of the dollar relative to other currencies, and may more broadly impact the appeal of the United States as an investment destination.
Mr. Ferguson, a few years ago, not long ago, you wrote this book here, this fantastic book. Yeah, I love this book. And you, one of the things that you wrote here is that China will become the most powerful nation in the world, surpassing even the States. Has it changed?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, China's problems have been greatly magnified by recent developments since I wrote the book, and the crisis caused by the pandemic has hit the economy quite hard. On the other hand, if you wanted to point to an economy that has a V-shaped recovery in the world today, it would be China. And China will probably achieve positive growth this year, even if it's low. And the US is almost certainly going to have negative growth. Mm-hmm. So the trend for the Chinese economy to catch up with the US economy may even have been accelerated by what's happened this year, because the growth differential could be quite big between the two economies. I think the sense I have, though, is that China's reaching certain limits of what a one-party system can achieve. And because since I wrote that book, the direction of the leadership under Xi Jinping has been distinctly back to the dominance of ideology, back to the dominance of the government and the party. I do think that the prospects of a more liberal and more dynamic China have receded. And what we see are certain symptoms of the old Soviet pathologies. China's demographic headaches are really serious. The workforce is shrinking. And China has made itself a whole bunch of new enemies in the past 6 months. So I think it's a story in which, in raw numbers, China is still on track to overtake the US at some point in current dollar GDP terms in the next 10 years. But if you actually ask, what could go wrong in China? there are some pretty obvious things that are very hard to fix in a one-party state. I mean, if you create the biggest middle class in history, they all make some money. But you say to them, well, we don't really have the rule of law here. We can actually just confiscate your property if we dislike you politically or if you get on the wrong side of some local party official. That is not the rule of law. So I think China's great vulnerability is that the party can't really subordinate itself to the law. And unless it does so, the alienation of the middle class is quite likely to grow. I don't think people in educated China are particularly happy with the direction the country's going in. But because they're all under surveillance, they have to watch what they say these days. So I think China's actually made a series of mistakes since I wrote Civilization, which is, gosh, I mean, getting on for 10 years ago. And I think those mistakes are going to ultimately lead to pretty disastrous consequences. Not that they're the Soviet Union, obviously, but there are certain Soviet pathologies there. And you saw them in Wuhan. I mean, Wuhan was Chernobyl. The same things happened. There's a screw up because everybody's not really doing their job very well. The doctors spot the problem. The officials say, oh, shut up, or we'll really lock you away. And weeks pass before, you know, the real scale of the disaster is admitted. And I sense that at the core of the Chinese system, despite the fancy economy, the private sector, the tech companies, at the core, it's the Soviet Union. It's one party system with all the corruption and the lying that goes on in those systems. And that means that ultimately it can't win. That system can't win. It's too screwed up. It'll do something like this again. It already did SARS. It did this in SARS and it's done it again with SARS-CoV-2. The next disaster could be even worse. That doesn't seem like the vision. That doesn't seem like the 21st century model to me.
And at the same time, we're seeing this tension escalating between the China government and the US. How do you see that? The tension between these two nations?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that we've been in Cold War II for some time. I think I first wrote about that February last year, and Cold War II has only got worse since the pandemic. I think that the range of issues has grown. We're now arguing about who started the pandemic, which countries should be allowed to use Huawei's hardware in their 5G networks. Can the Chinese impose a new national security law on Hong Kong? Is the United States effectively recognizing Taiwan as an independent state? And there's other issues too, currency issues, alternative forms of payments, artificial intelligence. And then there's the reality that China is waging cyber war and information warfare on the US right now. I mean, and at a higher level than we've seen. So I think Cold War II is here to stay. Last week, there was a bit of detente because Trump sort of backed down on China and the Chinese slightly dialed it back on Taiwan. I think both governments are quite risk averse and don't want to get into a hot war. The talk on trade is a little bit more positive. But, you know, that's a little detente in the midst of Cold War. When I look at what the Chinese are saying and doing and the extent to which it seems likely that they're trying to exacerbate American social divisions, I think we're in a bad place. It's like 2016 and the Russians. Look at TikTok, Chinese company, which teenagers use to post stupid dance moves, right? Until now. Now they use it to denounce their parents as racists. I mean, how fucked up is that? But that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that we're seeing. So I think that any relaxation of tensions between Trump and Xi or between Washington and Beijing is a little temporary interlude. The basic direction of travel is Cold War II. And I think we will have a showdown at some point, not over Hong Kong, but over Taiwan, where if the US follows through with its threat to cut Huawei off from TSMC semiconductors, TSMC is Taiwan-based company, which produces the highest end microprocessors. If you cut Huawei off from TSMC, Huawei can't function. And that threat hangs over Huawei right now, which means at some point there will be, I think, quite possibly a serious showdown over Taiwan. And the Chinese know that the Americans don't have a credible war plan to defend Taiwan anymore. They used to have, but they don't anymore. That seems like the world's most potentially dangerous spot. And I don't think that's about to change. In fact, I think you could imagine some Taiwan crisis later this year.
In the major events in history as a whole, yeah, there is usually a great person, a figure, I would say a great leader. That person to be remembered as a leader. Can you see that person right now? Can you see this leader right now? Why it has been so hard to have a great leader right now?
Well, the qualities of politics in the democratic world have been greatly changed structurally in recent years. So that politics as a career has become less attractive. It's an extremely exposed place you occupy if you enter the public sphere, even as a writer. But if you enter it as a legislator or a governor, you are exposed to a relentless bombardment of attack on social media. And I think most normal people think there has to be a better way of earning a living that will leave my family with more peace of mind. So there's that. And then there's the second problem, which is that the politics has become a branch of entertainment in the age of the internet. You know, we used to, in the days of television, to have entertainment and news, and they were separate. And I remember as a kid when the entertainment would stop at 6 p.m., there would be the news. And as a kid, I'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm out the room at this point because it's going to be boring. It's going to be boring people talking about boring things. Harold Wilson talking about the public sector borrowing requirement. What 8-year-old gives a damn? But now the internet has caused news and entertainment to fuse into one strange genre, which is part reality television and part shock jock talk radio. And oddly enough, we actually consume vastly more news now than we did before, because there's an addictive quality to this sensational drama of Bolsonaro or Trump or Boris Johnson. And these are entertaining figures like politicians didn't used to be. This means that we attract into politics the kind of people who are thick-skinned, don't care about being hated on, who are star-like, charismatic, attract our eyes and our interest in their public and private lives. And these, unfortunately, are people who lack any administrative competence. Because you've selected for the wrong qualities. You've selected for thick skin and charisma. But then you confront those people with a problem, which is a complex problem involving a great many uncertainties. And you say, look, in order to avoid really serious economic and social trouble, we need to act now and do these costly things, but it'll be worth it. Here's the cost-benefit analysis. Those people don't understand that kind of argument. Their only question is, yeah, but what's the tweet? How does this affect my image? So we've created a selection process for politicians which is calculated to filter out administrative competence.
I just want to make one question about Brazil, if you don't mind. major publications like Financial Times, Washington Post, The Telegraph in England have criticized the Brazilian president and the way he is leading our country through the pandemic. How are you seeing that? Are you following the news about Brazil?
I think it's fair to say that I was a defender of President Bolsonaro's government from the moment of his election, even actually before his election, because it seemed to me that Paulo Guedes had a very convincing plan for reform of Brazil's economy. And you could forgive Bolsonaro a lot of his demagogic style if it allowed a kind of free market reform program to happen. And so last year, I was excited to see pension reform get done and privatization begin to be prepared. And it was going well. Then the pandemic came along and it created, I think, a perfect storm for Brazil. Now, normally, as I said, that there's a tendency for people to focus in the media on the leader and make it all about him. That happens in Brazil, it happens in the US, it happens in the UK. And it's not actually all about the president in a public health crisis. It's really the public health bureaucracy that has a job to do. And in some countries, they did a good job. But I don't think they did a good job in our countries. I can't speak for the detail in Brazil, but I know the detail in the US. It was not Donald Trump's fault that CDC completely failed to ramp up testing, but actually reduced testing in the early part of the pandemic. It was not Donald Trump's fault that the Department of Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary for Preparedness totally failed to do his job. This was a major failure of bureaucracy. And I suspect in Brazil, something similar may have happened. It certainly also happened in the UK. But it all gets blamed on the president. And I think that the Northern Hemisphere has been hating on Bolsonaro all along. The New York Times view of Brazil is that it's practically a military dictatorship. And Bolsonaro's somehow even worse than Trump, if the New York Times can imagine that. And I think that coverage has been extremely unfair and misleading. I have good friends in São Paulo, and I'm in regular contact with people there, and they've consistently told me the coverage is too negative, the situation is not as bad. Yes, there's a political crisis. Moro left the government. That wasn't good. The arguments between the president and state governors are, not good. The same stuff is going on in the US in essence. You've got almost more turnover in the US government than in the Brazilian government. And I think that Northern Hemisphere commentary just tends to make it seem worse than it is. Economically as well as politically. So I think if you're based as I am in the US and talking about Brazil, the first thing you have to do is say to people that that version of Brazil that you read about in the New York Times is really misleading, that there was actually a lot of popular support for reform in Brazil, that there was a lot of frustration with problems of crime in Brazilian cities, that Bolsonaro had actually quite broad support for what he was trying to do. And you should no more understand Brazilian politics by looking at social media than that you should understand American politics by just looking at social media. I think as long as Guedes is still in the government, there's some reason for optimism that ultimately Brazil will come through the pandemic and there will be some chance to relaunch the reform campaign. And that's what I would focus on. I think if Guedes left the government for whatever reason, then I would be much more negative. But I do regard him very highly. I think he's that rare thing, a real reformer with a really solid grasp of the market economy. And he's been largely written out of the coverage in the Northern Hemisphere, you wouldn't really know he existed if you read the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that Trump, play down the fact that the pandemic is killing a lot of people, the pandemic is doing, is harming our economy. Trump and Bolsonaro play down the whole thing. Don't you think that it's a wrong message for both countries?
Remember that the epidemiologists who were most influential back in March were the guys at Imperial College London, mm-hmm. one of whom has very much the same name as me, Neil Ferguson. Spells it differently.
Yeah.
Luckily. And they said that if we didn't lock down the economy, 2 million Americans would die and 500,000 people in Britain, and they had some huge number for Brazil too. I think the correct response to that was, you guys are exaggerating the risk. Mm-hmm. The wrong response was, you guys are exaggerating, it's no worse than influenza, than a seasonal flu. Somewhere in between the two was where the truth lay. The Imperial College guys were definitely exaggerating the risk, but it was wrong to say, this is just the flu, it's no big deal. The reality is that COVID-19 is kind of in between. And so both President Trump and President Bolsonaro were, I think, instinctively skeptical of the very negative scenarios, and they were right to be. But the danger was to then go all the way to the other extreme and say, it's a nothing burger, it's no big deal. We don't need to wear masks, we don't need to do any of that stuff. And then you actually are sending the wrong signal, because we know from successful countries that if people observe social distancing and wear masks in public, this is not that difficult a disease to contain. But as soon as you relax, which is what we're doing in the US right now, and simply go about normal business without masks and without social distancing, the number of cases just goes up. And so I think we've seen a failure of public information. We haven't really communicated to the public what the right course of action is. In fact, we've confused people with constantly changing messages to the point that they'll now believe any lunacy that they see on the internet about COVID-19. And this is the problem with populist leadership. It's not naturally attracted towards a consensus of how best to conduct yourself in a pandemic based on the available scientific knowledge. That's just not the populist way. The populist way is that if you say this is really serious, I'm going to say it's totally unserious.
I have one more question, then I'll let you go. It's about racism. We are now watching what is happening in America, in the UK, the protests and all that. Racism is a sad part of the American history. Why is it so difficult to root it out?
Well, this is a question that requires a half hour answer at least. I think if one is measuring racism by overt racism, then when I first came here at the age of 17 in 1981, when I, coming from Scotland, was shocked by how much racist language I heard. By most measures, there has been significant progress by most economic measures since then. But that's not really what these protests are about. The protests are about a specific issue, which is police violence, police use of force, triggered by a really hideous case in Minneapolis. And there is a problem of police use of force in the United States, which is correlated to the prevalence of firearms, because the police In the US have good reason to fear that suspects are armed, they tend to be very heavy-handed. We know from really good research by people like Roland Fryer that the police in America are much more likely to use non-lethal physical force, including pushing and shoving and handcuffing, on African Americans relative to white people. But we also know from Roland's work that they are not more likely to use lethal force. If anything, they actually slightly more likely to use lethal force against white suspects. And when you adjust for crime rates, this is even more striking. So the protests start from the premise that there is a problem of police violence, which there is, and that it is motivated by racism, which it may be in some cases. But they then leap to a general proposition that there is a national and indeed transnational problem of racism that is rooted in the past, going all the way back to the 17th and 18th centuries. And so it's a huge leap to go from there's a problem of police brutality to it's all racism, to, and that's rooted in history. Brazil had slavery longer than most countries. It extended into the later 19th century. There's probably as much prejudice associated with skin color in Brazil as in countries in the Northern Hemisphere. But I don't see comparable protests happening in Brazil. What I see is that a wave of indignation amongst African Americans who've had a rough time with the pandemic and a rough time with the economy got kind of adopted by mostly white progressives for their own political purposes. And the protests escalated and became copied as a viral phenomenon, you know, with social media as the main vector of transmission, to the point that people are rioting in Bristol, England, and in Glasgow, Scotland, about something that happened in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This illustrates that there are two pandemics in the world today, one of which is COVID-19, and the other of which is a viral phenomenon online, where particular issues can become global waves of protest. And in the process of their transmission, the key issue gets lost sight of. The key issue, as I said at the beginning, is that there's a problem of excessive use of force by police. And if you drill down, there's a problem that many police officers are responsible for most, a small number of police officers are responsible for most complaints. The guy Derek Chauvin had 30 complaints against him for excessive use of force. That's a very, very high number. Why wasn't he fired? He'd already been involved in multiple questionable incidents. Well, the answer is actually that the police union is so powerful, it's really hard to fire people, even when they are really bad cops. That's the issue. But nobody in the streets of Bristol or Glasgow, or for that matter, New York, has the remotest understanding of these issues, because it's very quickly ceased to be a practical policy problem. Why did the police do this stuff? And what can we do to stop them doing it? We've moved into a totally different domain where you're really engaged in large-scale virtue signaling rather than addressing a specific problem. And you certainly don't want to hear the data when Roland Fryer says, hey, folks, they're as likely to do that shit to a white guy as to a black guy. Nobody wants to hear that because it spoils the narrative that this is all about slavery or white supremacy. I find that frustrating because, as Fryer shows in his work, often the investigations that go on in the wake of a viral incident lead the police to dial back their presence on the streets and the homicide rate goes up. And so you end up with more African Americans losing their lives because the police have basically checked out. I think the more we attack the police and the more this becomes about defunding the police rather than reforming or improving the police, the more we'll end up with crime going up in some of the affected cities. And that's the kind of perverse outcome that you get if you turn a policy issue into a symbolic opportunity for parading your woke political credentials.
You don't deny that we still have a racist problem all over the world, actually, in Brazil, in America, in the UK, and in Europe as a whole?
Of course not. It's obvious. But I think there's a need to try to identify problems that can be addressed with policy. If you're concerned about police use of force and the fact that there are some officers who perpetrate these sorts of outrageous acts of violence, then what are we going to do about that? Can we actually fix that problem? And that gets lost sight of very quickly. You know, how can we make racism go away where you can stigmatize it? We've been trying to do that for decades. It's, you know, vanished from popular culture. You can't, you know, say a racist thing on the media. You can be have your career wrecked if you even appear to have done that. So this kind of cultural campaign against racism goes back a long way. I mean, when I was a teenager, there were sort of great anti-Nazi, anti-racist protests in the UK. There is a question in my mind about how far these kind of campaigns will ever really transform the world's culture into one of universal tolerance. That would be great. I happen to be married to a black woman. We have two mixed race sons. Racism is a big problem for our family because at some point they will be teenagers and the US police will regard them almost certainly as African American. So it matters a great deal to me that we have these attitudes in our society, even if they don't lead to disproportionate use of lethal violence, they do lead to disproportionate use of non-lethal violence. That's a bad thing. So yeah, be wonderful if one could make it disappear. I worry about it on a regular basis with respect to our own family. Yeah. But the question is, what can really be done at this point to stigmatize racism further? Does it help for a daughter to post on TikTok an argument with her parents, which implies that they're racist? Is that helpful for children to denounce their parents? Frankly, I doubt that. Does it help to pull down statues and vandalize public property, which is a product of the history of a city like Bristol? Is that going to really change attitudes towards race? Frankly, I doubt it. Iconoclasm does not have a great track record in history of making things better. So, yeah.
As well as putting statues down, torn down statues like in Bristol or in Oxford or...
Right. How much is that really going to affect the situation of African-American communities? I would say not in the slightest.
Again, I need to say, in this book here, you write a lot about racism and the supremacists and this wrong idea that it comes from a prosperity idea that the white people have over the black people. Well, thank you very much. Are you writing a new book, Mr. Ferguson?
Always.
What is that
about? When I'm not being interviewed, I try to write books.
Okay. What is that about?
Well, I'm writing a short a short history of catastrophes called The Politics of Doom.
Oh, excellent.
Which will look at why we as a species are quite bad at dealing with even predictable disasters.
When does that come out?
That'll be out early next year.
Oh, thank you. Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you.
My pleasure. Yeah. I hope that was useful and
We have like four pages here, I'm sure.
Well, let me see it when you finally go live, and I'll look out for it, and I can tweet it to my Portuguese reading followers. There must be some.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you. Are you send it to Lisa?
Yes. She can pass it on to me. That'd be great.
Thanks,
Daniel.
Thank you.
Really good to speak to you.
Yeah. Thank you. My pleasure.